My immediate right is Mike Petriello, whose face you've likely seen on television from MLB Advanced Media. To his right, Darren Willman, who's also the genius behind Baseball Savant. And now for the greatest reveal since we found out that Soylent Green was people. On the end, please welcome the great Tom Tango. And we'll take questions in just a few minutes. I'll moderate that. But Mike, Darren, and Tom have a brief presentation on kind of where things have come and where they are heading through as we start year number three with StatCast. Mike?
Yeah, brief is a hopeful word because we have a lot of stuff we want to go through today. And we get to follow Bill James getting a Lifetime Achievement Award, so no pressure there. Listen, StatCast has been around for 2 years, right? 2 years in baseball time is not very long at all. And what's really cool is a lot of this stuff has already permeated the baseball vocabulary. Like Chris Bryant talks about his launch angle. Mark Trumbo talks about his launch angle. Everybody probably already knows Seth Lugo and the spin rate story. Like these guys are already talking about this, and we think it's already made changes to the way the game is played. And that's really cool. And so the way we've started is like just observing. You know, what do you see? What can you count? What can you measure? Moving into metrics. And then, you know, I think there was a big story last week about how we're going to create a new wins above replacement. Maybe a little premature for that. We're not quite there yet. That's a long way off. But what we are doing is really getting a lot of progress made into what we can measure and turning that into skills. We want to make this more baseball, and we want to get it in a way that the common fan can appreciate, as well as all of you super fans here.
Right, so as Mike just mentioned, the way we're kind of structuring this right now is the first couple years we were observing a lot of things, exit velocity, route efficiency, the various metrics. And what we're able to do now that the sample size is a little larger is we're able to start coming up with metrics. Tom's helped out with barrels, and just recently we came up with hit probability and catch probability.
And we're online now, so let's do this for real now.
All right.
So anyway,
we're warmed up. Good advantage.
Yeah, we're I used to experience put to good use. So anyway, here are some of the big fancy numbers, which you can see most of. Anyway, over the last 2 years, we have recorded like 1.5 million pitches. You can see 300,000 balls in play. The numbers kind of speak for themselves. Like this is a massive data set in just 2 years. And as you can imagine, this is going to keep increasing as time goes on. And I will hope that the rest of this is in the middle and not on the edges. This is kind of what we were just talking about, the vocabulary here, you know, the launch angle, exit velocity. It's really cool how quickly this has permeated baseball. And kind of what Darren was just talking about here, you know, you start at the bottom. What can you observe? You know, then you turn that into a metric, which we just introduced our first metric last year, which we'll get to in a second, is barrels. It turns into skills, ratings, and eventually a player value system, whether that's war, whether that's something else. We don't know yet, but that's obviously going to be an output goal because we have great data. This was our first metric last year. It was a barrel, and we called it that because exit velocity is awesome. You want to hit the ball hard, but you don't want to hit the ball hard straight up or straight down. You want a great combination of exit velocity and launch angle. So this was something we worked with Tom on. It's the perfect combination of those two things. If you barrel the ball up, that's a batting average of over 800. It's like the best thing a hitter can do, and it only happens 6% of the time. And there's a lot of other batted ball types that we'll get to in a second. And then one other cool thing we did last year is, you know, putting data towards injury monitoring. So what you can see on the right there, that's Carlos Correa, his exit velocity chart. And I labeled where he played through pain, but I probably didn't need to, because I think it's pretty clear where he was trying to play through an ankle, play through a shoulder. And the performance just wasn't there. You know, the other one is Bryce Harper's throwing strength. Everybody talking about, is Bryce Harper playing through a right shoulder injury? He refused to confirm it. I look at that last 2 months of the year, and that also corresponds to them playing shallower. And I say, there's something there.
So here, what we noticed is that at various launch angles, you get different kinds of performance. So at 12 degrees, that's when you get the maximum batting average. But at 28 degrees is where you get the maximum power. So that's where the hitters are trying to hit launch angles, somewhere around 12 to 28. And then this is for exit speed. Up until 88 miles an hour, there's not much difference in terms of the impact of the performance. But then starting from there and going up, up to around 115, the performance keeps going much higher. And then starts to tail off a little bit, and we'll explain the reason for that a little later.
And you can hit the ball too hard.
You can definitely hit the ball too hard.
So that was just a brief sampling of the stuff we've done. We could have done a 10-hour presentation just on what we've learned to date, but we have so much we want to get to. So we're going to show you some of the new stuff for this year, and then after that, we've got Tom has a lot of really cool stuff that you know, we're going to get through. So the first one here, yeah, Darren, you want to start with this.
What we're looking at here, and this is a really cool chart for data people especially. So on the red dots on the left are all the outs by outfielders. All the green are all the base hits that were hit to outfielders, and then the blue is base hits or outs that were caught by another outfielder that wasn't the guy that we're talking about. So if you look in the middle there, the red and the green, that's what we're really concerned about, because you can look at the top red, those are for sure outs. The green are for sure hits, the big chunks. But in the middle, you have some red and some green mixed in there, and that's what we're really concerned about, because those are the plays that we're deeming five stars or highlight plays. And it correlates to what we've already observed. If you look on the right, this is hang time and the distance an outfielder had to cover. And if you notice, the gradient in the middle, those are about your 50% plays, that 50% of outfielders and 50, would have caught or it would have been a base hit.
Well, we can talk about this as it's going on. Basically, the history of fielding, you know, it started with fielding percentage for how many years? And we all know that's bogus. You know, if you're not good enough to get to the ball, you can't be charged with an error. That's a terrible way to measure defense. We moved on to advanced stuff, DRS, UZR, much more a sound fundamental basis. You know, how hard was the play? How often was it made? But it was based on a lot of human inputs, and so there's, you know, obvious issues with that. So we are moving on to what we can measure. You know, so catch probability, which we introduced last week at Sloan, which you may be familiar with. How far did you have to go to get the ball? How much time did you have to get there? And as time goes on, we'll add for direction, we'll add for walls. But for right now, it's those two things. You can put a percentage on any batted ball. So let's ask, I always forget the slides here. So you can say, yeah, we have five-star plays, four-star plays. And I think this will be a really effective way, just on a broadcast, to say, well, that was a four-star play, or that ball gets caught 90% of the time, or 10% of the time, based on the numbers. The design on the right is an example of what we're working on, how we may show this on Darren's site. And you know, you'll be able to make those for any player, which I think is really cool. Now, this is a question for you. Was this a great play? It looks like a great play. Yeah, everybody's saying no, because everybody knows, you know, who it is. Isn't that, but really, the point here is, you see the distance, you see the hang time. Without context, you have no idea what those numbers mean. And we didn't always do a great job of adding context, and that's what we're trying to do better on. The data here shows you that this ball gets caught 75% of the time. You can see the route here wasn't that great, and that's a really cool way. It's like the eye test isn't always the right answer. This one looks pretty good. And as you can see, it is good. It's a 7% catch rate. So two great-looking plays with very different numbers behind them. And that's great for analytical tools. It's also just great for narrative storytelling.
So what we're able to do now with this data is we're able to ask the question, if Mike Trout was hit this ball, would he have caught it, a catch that Billy Hamilton made? So what you're looking at here, those little blobs that are growing is Mike Trout's range last year to a ball that Lorenzo Cain, and I'm talking about the one on the left. So based off the hang time that we've observed of Mike Trout, he would not have been able to catch that ball. And so we're able to start taking all these metrics and create cool visualizations that we can start, people can start to use and leverage and ask the question. I mean, that's the age-old question. Would this player have made a play that Billy Hamilton made or a play that somebody else didn't make? We're able to start answering that.
So that was catch probability, which we've already started using on MLB Network for the WBC. In last night's game, you might have seen it. The other new thing for this year is hit probability, and it's the exact same idea. I don't have to explain to you all why batting average is flawed. You all know that. OPS is better, weighted runs created is better, but it's still based on outcomes. You know, if you crush a ball and the outfielder makes a great play, it's still an ofer. And that's not really about skills. We're trying to get back to skills. You see the Mike Trout freeze frame there. He hits that ball really hard. You don't know the outcome of it. But whether the center fielder makes a great play or falls on his face, that shouldn't have anything to do with what Mike Trout did. We're trying to get back to the baseball skills, which I think is really cool. So here's another example. You can use it for hitters or pitchers. This is Matt Cain. Matt Cain did his job, right? Ball's not hit that hard, very high pop-up. 5% of the time that lands for a hit. Overwhelmingly, that's an out. Didn't even reach the warning track. But you can see the outfielder messed it up so badly, he didn't even get charged with an error. So are we really going to kill Matt Cain and say he got a double and maybe an earned run? Traditionally, yeah. But that's not what we want to do anymore. We want to say he showed the skill, even though the outcome didn't necessarily work in his favor. So that's really exciting for us. And if you accumulate all those over the course of a season, you can come up with an estimated weighted on base or OPS or however you want to show it. You're not surprised Kershaw's number one here from last year. The gap between one and two might be surprising, but Kyle Hendricks is really the story because the big question was, is he good or is the Cubs defense making him look good? By this has nothing to do with Cubs defense. This is just showing Kyle Hendricks actually showed some real skill. I should note this also does include strikeouts and walks. It's not just on contact. So that's a pretty cool story for us.
All right, so you're probably, you're all here to hear Tom talk. So enough of Darren and I. So Tom here has a bunch of really interesting things, and each one of these deserves like an hour-long dissertation, but we're gonna go through them relatively quickly, and you know, obviously any questions afterwards. So Tom, start off.
So we have millions of data points, and what we're trying to do always is trying to organize it. Organize in such a way that we can start asking questions. So in this particular case, what we've got is we split up all the batted balls based on their performance. The barrels is the easy one, the one that we talked about. But then there's also the near barrels, the solid contacts, those that were missed out on being barrels by a few miles an hour or a few degrees. And those are also solid impacts, as you can see by the WOBA. And then we can look at the third group, which is the flares and burners. So those are the ones that are either solid contact or a good angle, but not both. Even so, it's still a very high impact batted ball. So once we've gone through those three, all that's left is all the below average batted balls. So there's the weak contacts, and then the hit under and the hit overs. So this speaks very much to the way you would normally think of a hitter. And now that we've organized all the data in this manner, we can now create leaderboards, we can identify hitters, we can say Ryan Schimpf hits under the ball a lot. We can find similar players, we can look at how they're going to do in the future. So it's a great way to be able to segment all that data. This one is an interesting one. This was Giancarlo Stanton at the Home Run Derby. He had 80 batted balls, so we captured them all. And if you look at the 25 degrees, so the y-axis on both is the vertical launch angle. The x-axis is distance on the left and speed on the right. His median was 25 degrees. So what's great about this is that this was the ideal experiment. It's the same hitter against the same pitcher in the same park, trying to do the same thing at the same time. And we can see, therefore, that he was going for 25 degrees. Everything was around the 25 degrees. Half of his balls were hit 20 to 30 degrees. So we know that that's what he's trying to do. But what's also interesting is that if you look at the far right, he had three batted balls hit over 120 miles an hour, but two of them were at 10 degrees. And if you trace it back to the left side, you'll see that the distance of those balls were under 350 feet. So that's the interesting part, that you want to hit the ball hard, but not too hard, because if you hit it too hard, you're probably hitting it flush, and the batter is trying to give up some speed to get some sort of loft. And this just groups the data in terms of 5 miles an hour. You can see from 0 to 60, there's really not much difference, all the way up to around 80. Then you get the donut hole between 80 and 85. You can think of those as balls hit to the outfielder, so that's why the batter's not going to want to hit it there. And then it gets progressively higher and higher up until around one point, 115 miles an hour or so, where the production starts going down. So here, this is all balls hit at 95 miles an hour at 30 degrees. And that's the spray chart, which you can see on Savant right now. The WOBA for that combination is 434. Now, you could also see the combination, the WOBA for any kind of combination. You can see at 96 miles an hour, it jumps up by over 100 points. At 94 miles an hour, it drops down by 80 points. So it's very sensitive, the performance, based on the speed, at least for this particular launch angle. So once we do that, we have 130,000 batted balls. Let's apply the same method to every single batted ball. So let's take every batted ball and add 1 mile an hour. And what happens? So in this particular case, league-wide, the WOBA would go up by 17 points if you add 1 mile an hour, and similar impact if you subtract 1 mile an hour. And then for the launch angle, if you add 1 degree, the impact goes up by 4 points, and if you subtract 1 degree, it goes down by 4 points. Now, this is league-wide. Every hitter is different. So we can see Ryan Howard is the hitter who's most impacted by his speed. So him adding 1 mile an hour, subtracting 1 mile an hour, that 2 mile an hour difference, has an impact to his overall WOBA of 38 points. So that includes his walks and strikeouts. Now, I should point out that you can't just add 1 mile an hour and add 1 degree without something else happening. And chances are you're going to strike out more. You have to start your swing earlier. You're going to hit under the ball. something's going to happen. So we're not saying that this is what's going to happen, but of the guys that are most susceptible to changing their approach, these would be the guys. And similar for and for the speed, some guys like Billy Hamilton aren't affected at all. So whether he would hit the ball 1 mile an hour more or less, his performance would remain the same. And then similar for the launch angle.
Sorry, I jumped ahead here. I can't tell how excited I am in the picture. Kelly Leek smoking a cigarette in our fancy Sabre deck here. Explain, Tom, why we're talking about this.
All right. So like I said, we're always trying to organize the data in such a manner that we can try to tell some sort of story. And we were trying to identify those outfielders who were supposed to catch the easy fly balls but did not. And they did not because one of his teammates went out of his way to catch that fly ball. So I explained this story to one of the VPs, and right away he says, Kelly Leek. And then 10 minutes later, I go and ask somebody else, and they present the same story, and he blurts out, Kelly Leek. And so we have the Kelly Leek leaderboard, and we see that Herrera led the league last year with 6 times that he raced for a ball that somebody else was camped under.
I can't wait till the Phillies come to town so I can go ask the corner outfielders about all this.
Well, and it's funny that, you know, we bring this up because me and Mike were at a spring training game 2 days ago, and a ball was hit to a left fielder, and a center fielder came racing over, but it fell between them. So we wouldn't have caught it in the Kelly Leek, but it was the same situation.
So going along the lines of trying to organize the data, we track the position of all the players on the field at all times for every pitch. So we're trying to, since they can be anywhere, we're trying to group it in such a way that we can try to identify certain patterns and zones. So this one is for the third baseman against left-handed hitters. The red zones is where he's normally stationed, where you'd expect him to be, what I call here standard back and standard in. But they can be anywhere. He could be guarding the line. He could be in. He could be in the shortstop spot, second base spot, right field rover. So we're basically, all we're doing is saying, based on where he's playing, we're going to group him in this particular zone. So once we do that one, we could do it for all the fielders against lefties and righties. So the top line is right-handed hitters, third, short, second, first. And those are where their standard zones are. And then the bottom three is for the outfielders, which are more consistent between righties and lefties.
So what's cool with something like this is a team like the Cubs, where they don't really get credited with a ton of shifts, but they say they shift. There's a lot of different ways to shift. So they might not be extreme over to one side, but they've moved a little bit. And something like this, we'll be able to really pick up on that.
Right. And what's good is that we have all the data. Everything's classified. And Baseball Savant is going to be able to use that data.
And it makes it not binary. Like, I mean, you could say, yes, there was a shift. But this gives it a lot more detail to run different splits. And, you know, is it successful? Should they be doing that?
And it's important to be able to visualize it, which kind of leads us into you right here.
Right. So this year, the first 2 years, we were doing a lot of data collecting. We were putting out visuals, but hopefully this year, we're working on a new framework to put out new visuals very agile, quickly. And so these are a few that we've got cooking up in our what we were calling our lab. The top left one is a very intuitive way to show launch angle, exit velocity, how high it went, and the result. That's going to be in game day this year. We put a lot of work into it. We think it looks really good. The rest are more kind of just things we're cooking up. Like the one on the far right is an interesting visual. It looks like a big blob, but that's every batted ball in Game 7 of the World Series, where the players started on the play, the trajectory of the ball. So we're playing a lot with different angles. What tells the best story to relay this data to the user? And that way you can get, you know, best bang for your buck. So the one in the middle is kind of cool too, bottom middle. It shows a percentage based off where each batted ball went, along with trajectory. We have it at like a 45-degree angle. We think that best shows the trajectory. So we're very cognizant of wanting to still tell a story. This data is very complicated, so it's not helpful to just put out numbers if you can't tell a story from some type of visual. And as Tom was alluding, we're trying to make as much data as accessible as possible. So Baseball Savant is basically our lab where we're going to put out new information, new visuals for people to consume. So today I added a catch probability leaderboard. So what you can do is you can go on it, see who made the most five-star plays, the percentage that they made, all the way down to one star. We're going to be continuing to add to that.
Yeah, what you see on the list there is what's available now by opening day, but that is not the entirety of what will be available. We hope to keep adding more and more stuff, like the cool charts you can make. That's Mookie Betts, but you can go there and make one for any outfielder right now. So that's just like a fraction of the things we're doing, but we didn't want to make a 10-hour presentation. But yeah, that's what we have for you today.
Right, folks, if you have questions, go ahead and write them on the note cards. Jeff is our lovely assistant. He's coming around to collect those. So make sure you get your questions in on the note card. We have one that's already been submitted. And before we get into StatCast, people want to know, Tom, the derivation of your pseudonym, Tom Tango.
One of my old jobs, there was somebody in the military that was one of our employees. And he was teaching us the military alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. So we thought it would be fun if we all just adopted our initials as based on the military alphabet. So since I'm Tom, Tango is the T for the military, and that's where it came from.
That's pretty great. I want to go back to Tom, some of what you talked about with regards to the batted ball data when you were looking at the weighted on base average of barrels, flares, the three areas where it looked like the weighted on base percentage, weighted on base average was well above 600. What do you think, if any, there is correlation on average and balls in play on something like that if you were to add, say, home runs into the batting average on balls in play data?
The barrels that we have, we could actually split it up even further. So if we were to limit it to 106 miles an hour at the same launch angles, those would be essentially super barrels. We don't have a good name for it. But those would be even more indicative of the talent.
Hashtag super barrel.
Yeah. Have you guys found that, I guess now that you have basically 2 years worth of data, that if there are players that have consistently hit the ball hard in 2015, do they generally correlate with 2016? Are you able to, what have you been able to see just kind of in terms of the differences between the 2 years? Is it a skill that repeats itself?
I think for the most part, I can't say we have actually done like a serious scientific correlation study, but other than guys who got injured, for the most part, yeah. I mean, Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera, these guys are up there from year to year, which makes sense because it's not just about outcome, we're trying to get to skill. Like, it takes a skill. You can't hit the ball 110 miles by accident. That's a good way to put it, right? And it takes real skill to be able to do that and to elevate. So for the most part, yeah, the guys at the top of that leaderboard have been pretty similar. Okay.
Look at Stanton.
Yeah.
He's the only guy to hit 120. He's done it four times.
Yeah, it's a real skill. You can't do that by accident.
The exit speed definitely repeats. So it's definitely an indicator of future talent. So whether you have past performance or just exit speed, those two together are pretty much in sync with how they correlate to the future.
What about with angle? Because there was an article just recently in the Arizona Republic, Nick Picoro wrote, talking about Paul Goldschmidt, who Goldschmidt was, I think, 2 years ago, right, the only player whose average exit velocity was above average every single week of the season. This year, he hit far fewer balls, more balls on the ground than he had in previous seasons. So when you look at, by comparison, players that go from 15 to 16, is launch angle far more variable on average for the hitters?
I don't know about more variable, but it's definitely a strong indicator as well. Anything like at above 20 degrees with the high speed, those two together, they give you a high correlation in terms of the talent of the player.
I think one of the interesting things too is growing up, I was always taught to swing down the ball, hit the ball down, hit the ball down. But what we're finding with the data, it's not necessarily true. You want to hit the ball up, you want to drive it. And I think that's been one of the cool things that StatCast has provided is, we can start to change some of these old philosophies that we're finding not to be true.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a cool project where I sent all of our beat writers to the guys who had a double-digit increase in home runs last year to ask the same three questions. And I was like, did you try to hit more home runs? Can you increase your launch angle, and why do you think you hit more home runs? And we're starting to get some of the answers back, and they're fascinating. Some guys are like, yeah, I'm trying to hit more home runs. And then Miguel Cabrera is like, I don't know, man, I just go up and hit the ball. But it's going to be cool. I'm really interested to see. Like, these are going to be like 50 guys, and if we can really see a pattern of like
launch angle is cool to me. I'm trying to elevate. Maybe that tells us a little bit about where extra home runs are coming.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because there's been a lot of talk about where the ball's juiced, right, in 2016. It was one of the biggest home run seasons of all time, right? We saw an enormous jump. I think it was 114 players hit 20 home runs or more. It was 114 or 117. And I wondered how much of it was a correlation between hitters who have changed their, because we see it in every Twitter hitting coach, we see it in every guy who's gone to the leg raise. I think Aaron Boone, if anybody was here last year, talked about the move, right, where they have a little bit of a hitch with their hand and a leg raise to try and get, to create that, to hit that ball in the air. If that's really where we're seeing this increase in home runs, how much of it is, you know, climate certainly could be a factor. Maybe if the balls were a little different, that would be a factor. But if guys are really trying to hit the ball in the air more, doesn't it stand to reason that that's why there are more homers?
I don't know if it's 100%. I think there's, like, Brian Mills did a very compelling one about the strike zone being an issue. You know, everybody thought it was the ball, and then Dr. Nathan kind of put out that study that said, I'm not so sure about that. So I do think this is part of it, because I think hitters using data has been has lagged behind pitchers, right? And I think the hitters are really starting to get smarter, and they're trying, and there's so many guys just talking about it. So I don't know if that'll answer the whole thing, but I think it's got to be part of it.
Well, like one of the what-ifs that you saw there, Chris Bryant for the launch angle, he was the one where whether he got one or less degrees on his launch angle, his impact, his WOBA was unchanged. And this is a guy who actively said, I will change my launch angle. And so it's very interesting that he may have figured out his perfect launch angle.
Because it's different for every guy. That, right?
Teams are getting smarter. They're finding ways to explain to these players that they need to change their approach, or they can change their approach, and it'll produce more home runs. They're hiring players now to help translate some of these things, whereas some analytics departments, it's been lost in translation. You have spreadsheets. Players don't want to look at spreadsheets. They want to be able to visually understand this, and if an ex-player that kind of can be the bridge between that gap can explain to them, like, you just need more launch angle. Look at this chart. Like, when you hit it last year at this launch angle, you hit 10 more home runs. So now they can practice that, and they can go in the cage, and they can work on these types of things.
Let's talk a little bit about the defensive stuff, and specifically the outfield defense that you guys have been working so hard on really over the last year. The 1 to 5 star plays that you have, as you kind of looked at those numbers and started to put it together, where did you feel like that kind of average defender lies? Or have you figured that out in there? Does the average defender make the 1, 2, 3 star plays at a 95% range? Where is that? Because I think we're always constantly, I'm always trying to figure out, okay, where is average so I can try and determine where somebody is?
You know what I found, maybe you guys have seen the same thing, is I found it most interesting that the guys who rated relatively poorly overall still had some pretty decent plays, right? Like, maybe consistency is the same thing in the field at the plate. Like, Lonnie Chisenhall is a great example. He made some really good plays, but overall rated only okay. I mean, the guys you'd expect to be at the top are at the top, right? Billy Hamilton is unbelievable. Kiermaier is unbelievable. Ender Inciarte, Adam Eaton. You know, average, I think we're still learning that. I mean, it's really brand new to us. We're excited to kind of see how it plays out in real time this year.
Yeah, one of the fascinating ones, too, was Max Kepler in right field for the Twins. He made, I think, 6 highlight plays, but he made a lot of bad plays. He had a really low percentage on 1 stars, which I found fascinating. Like, he's great at making exceptional plays, but sometimes he lacks, he doesn't make the routine plays.
Yeah, if I can read Tom's mind for a minute, the star system is really cool for, like, broadcast and the comment and fan, but it's not something you'd probably use so much for an analytical purpose, right? You can go back to the kind of the +1, -1.
Right. I mean, the way you're used to with UZR, that's like a very good way to do it. So what's the chance of him making it? If he does make it, you get plus above that, and if he doesn't make it, you get a big minus. So if it's a 75% play like we saw with the Kemp one, if he makes it, that's +0.25, but if he misses it, it's -0.75. So it's a solid accounting system, but the star system is a lot easier to describe and present in terms of broadcast.
With player range, you saw it on the Mookie Betts there, and you guys have done a lot of that. I think the Kevin Kiermaier one actually covered an entire outfield when you guys did the graphic
basically,
on that.
He's
right?
Really good. hot take, I know.
Mike, slow down. We got to make it all the way to 330. But in terms of, and again, I'll go back to average, in terms of being able to overlay that or see that with where an average defender at a position lies, will there be, or have you guys been able to take a look at and see, okay, this is where most players, even if it's instead of You know, the average, more like the medium, kind of the median area for where a corner outfielder, center fielder would make plays.
Well, I think one of the main things, like visually, if you're going to look at it, is you want to get rid of the noise. You want to get rid of the 100% plays that you know every outfielder is going to catch, and you want to get rid of all the base hits. And so that are for sure 100% base hits. And then that's where the true range for the outfielder lies. And then what you can start to do with that is you can start to compare against other outfielders and overlay another outfielder's range on top of that and say, okay, Billy Hamilton obviously gets way more range than, say, Mike Trout. Those type of things, league average can be a little harder because there's a lot of other variables that go into it, like how fast they're running and things like that.
But in terms of plays made, does there tend to be a number that, or an area that kind of stands out in that?
Well, for every combination of speed and distance, we've identified like how often the play is made. So, you know, at a particular running speed, if you get to like 30 feet per second, you know that that's an elite level. So whenever you see someone running at that speed, you know that what's about to happen is going to be a great play if he manages to keep the ball in the glove. And 25 feet, if you're running at 25 feet and less, you know it's a gimme. It's a jog, and we know that if that's the fastest a player ran and he caught that ball, you know you did not see something outstanding. So there's that range in between there where we can figure out how tough a play it was.
Yeah, we saw that last night at the WBC game. So Dalton Pompey makes this great diving catch last night, and the data comes back. It was like 85% catch probability. And right off the bat, you're like, okay, that's kind of odd. But when you look at the data, his speed wasn't that great. Right. You know, it took a fine
round. It
was like
26 or
20. Yeah, and you can see right away, we were watching it live, but it didn't look that fast. I mean, the data said that, and that backs up a number that, might not be what the eye test says.
Right, and it wasn't that, he can run faster than what he was running. It looked like he was, not dogging it. He caught the ball, but it looked like he wasn't running as hard as he could, and then he made an exceptional play. And we can look at the data now and kind of weigh that.
Yeah, it works both ways. I mean, we showed the Matt Kemp play, and here we are being buzzkills and saying it wasn't a great play, but it works the other way too. I mean, there's Adam Eaton has made a bunch of plays where it's a running catch, but it doesn't leave his feet, and you'd never see it on a highlight play or highlight reel. And then you look at the data and you say, that was actually an awesome play. He did a great job of getting there, and it's just a different way to look at it. It's another narrative device.
Really. Right. Kevin Kiermaier is the exact same way. Like, we'll look at the data, and he'll make an exceptional catch, but he's just so fast that he can cover a lot more ground than an average outfielder. That gives them a few more five-star plays.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the challenges, simply the optics. The optics won't necessarily match what the data is going to say. So because we don't see the player from the starting point, from the point where the ball's hit or the ball is thrown. So that's going to be like the big challenge in terms of trying to explain things to people. That's a big shift.
Tom, are you suggesting that an ex-ball player in the booth is going to have a hard time when a great diving play doesn't have great numbers to it?
We'll see.
That's going to be fun. Yeah, I can't wait.
Good answer. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Right.
Although I would argue that a lot of the ball players know that. I mean, I think it's probably more from the television viewer, right, that doesn't see the play before, because you're able to track not just reaction time, but positioning in terms of what somebody can do pre-pitch to be able to be in a position to make a play.
The camera lies to you. I mean, it really does, because by the time they cut to the outfield, the ball is already in the outfield. The guy's already moving, and you miss that. So it may look like he's going perfectly, but you didn't see him going this way first. And that's tough. What's interesting is kind of the way we've defined this. We talk to ball players and try to get their feedback. So when we say hang time for this, it's not actually off of bad ball contact. It's off of when the pitcher releases it, and that's what we call opportunity time. And, we saw Kevin Kiermaier talking about, I can read the catcher sign, so I get a little bit of a head start, And we talked to an outfielder a couple days ago at camp, and he's like, the shortstop when I played, he put his fingers behind his back, so I knew what kind of pitch it was going to be, so I get a head start. So I love that. And I think that's important for us, is not just to cook up these numbers and spreadsheets, but talk to actual ball players and say, does this pass the smell test for you, and does this fly? And so far, so good, but that's exciting for us to, be able to improve the numbers that way.
Future value metrics. I know Jeff Passan just recently wrote an article saying that you are the wave of the future. I don't know, was Jeff actually at Sloan, or was he just...
No, that was a phone call.
That's always a phone call that I love. Yeah. When Jeff calls, it's great. But we certainly understand what the limitations that wins above replacement may have, whether it be what you're using as a component for a defensive metric, or how you're, whether or not you're using weighted on base average or another metric in there. How do you guys view, I guess this is kind of more the initial thought, is it, do you view war as a jumping off point for it? Do you view an overall player evaluation system that's different than what wins above replacement is?
For me, war is simply going to be the byproduct of everything we do, because we're going to be so focused on the little things, things that you could actually see like on game day or in broadcast. So the things that you really can talk about and compare, so like catch probability, hit probability, steal, when we get the steals, we'll do the steals as well. So those are like very specific things. They're tools-based things. We're going to be speaking really the language of the scouts more than anything. At the end, the things will roll up into war, but that's just going to be, you know, it's just going to be the byproduct of everything else that's going to be interesting. It's not like we're going to see war on the screen, because it's got so much going into it. What we really care about is all the little components that makes up war. So that's why I'm not too concerned about what war is.
Yeah, I think Tom makes a good point. The Here Comes a New War, I think, took off a little bit more last week than we wanted it to, because, first of all, we're not ready for it yet. We haven't measured infield defense. There's a bunch of other things we want to include. At the end of the day, yeah, if we've got this data, we're going to want to make a player value number out of it. Is that the fourth version of wins above replacement, or is it something else? I don't think we know yet, but Tom's right. That's what's more important is drilling down and getting to the inputs.
Yeah, the way I say it is that we're in the third inning. So
yeah, the third, that's perfect.
We shouldn't be talking about it now.
I guess that was more my question, was less about, what would go into it, because clearly you're going to have potentially more tools-based data that would go into it that would seem to be accurate based on what the cameras and StatCast are catching, and more about the way it's consumed, because I do think that war is still scary for, now maybe for a younger generation, 20 years of people growing up with the statistic, they certainly have an understanding of it more, but it is, as a broadcaster, it's complex to try and explain what wins above replacement is in a succinct manner that carries weight with an audience. So is it on a replace, are you gonna use replacement level, or do you visualize something else that could come about that might be easier for people to understand for a win value on a player?
Well, one thing that I've done in the past is taken war and turned it into two dimensions. What I call the individualized win-loss record. And if you're familiar with Bill James, his win shares, same idea. You got wins and you got losses. So that's the way I see it. You don't have to worry about what the replacement level is. Just make sure that things add up for wins and losses so that everything's in balance. Again, the replacement level is just the byproduct of everything else that goes into it.
All right, so we have some questions from the audience here, and since, Mike, you mentioned infield defense, and in fact, we were just talking about this earlier. In fact, we talked about it the other day, too. There's a lot of talk about balls in the air. How do you determine fielding probability on ground balls, especially concerning middle infielders?
That is absolutely the right question. So we've put a lot of work into measuring outfield defense. That's what catch probability is. Infield defense is next, and I think people are surprised to find out it's so much harder than outfield defense to measure. In the outfield, if three guys, you pretty much know who's going to be where, and the ball takes a relatively constant path. The infield, there's so many other variables, right? There's not only just what kind of batted ball, because it's a hard liner, is it taking bounces? Are they shifted? Is a runner being held on? And so maybe he's on the base as opposed to being off the base. Then really why I'm not giving you a great answer is we don't have the answer yet. I mean, that's kind of one of our next big to-dos is measuring infield defense. And it's going to be in-depth, and there's a lot to it.
The one good use case for that one is the ball that's hit between shortstop and third base. So the ball may be closer to the third baseman, but if you add in the time component of being able to get to it and throw the ball, the shortstop might actually be closer in terms of making the play. So that's what the challenge is trying to figure out who is most responsible for a play and how much responsible is he.
The next one is, this is not from me, it's from somebody else. So presenter two says, I have also used weighted on base average to rank pitchers. What are your thoughts about using pitcher weighted on base average to calculate weighted runs against above average, and the idea that 10 points of WRAA equates to one win above average?
Well, the second part is true. 10 runs is one win. And definitely WOBA for pitchers certainly works. It works better if you use the batted ball profile that we just discussed and what Mike highlighted with Kyle Hendricks.
Do you assume all pitch locations have the same ideal pit launch angle?
That's a good one.
That's a great question.
That's a really good question. I mean, my assumption without having any of the data handy is no, probably not. I mean, if let's say we're right and that guys are trying to elevate more, and then pitchers will adjust for that. And I think I saw Jeff Sullivan or someone wrote the other day that they're already seeing more high fastballs because it's harder to get up to that. So I think the answer to that is no, it can't be. It can't be the same ideal across the entire location.
I would say the answer is always no. And the question, what we have to do is show how much it's different. So it's a great question, and that's what we should be showing is what's the launch angle at various pitch locations.
Somewhere in this room, I think Perry Husband is jumping up and down. PitchFX had a big impact because it was widely available. Will FieldFX be available and more HitFX, or is that basically the data that you have available on Baseball Savant now?
Well, I mean, technically those are different systems. I mean, FieldFX and HitFX, it's not StatCast. But you know, as far as the data available, we show, you know, Darren's done a great job of making that available. I remember when this got announced like 3 years ago, none of the three of us were working at the company yet. And I remember my reaction was probably the same as everybody else's at the time, which was, that's really cool, I hope I get to play with it. And the commissioner at the time said he wants there to be good access to the data and time. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. I remember the first year you could only get, what, exit velocity on home runs, and that was it. Now you can get exit velocity for every batted ball, spin rate for every pitched ball. We're going to be adding the defensive stuff up there. So, you know, it's really, it's important that the community get to be involved in this. And I think we're pretty happy with the happy medium we've struck with how much data is out there.
Yeah, and you can download all that data from Baseball Savant. If you go to the StatCast search, there's CSV dumps of anything. You can get as granular as you want. We hope to continue to add as we go along. But I mean, most of the data is all available.
This one is interesting because it goes back to outfield defense, and there was kind of a real-world application of this. In fact, we talked about this morning. We were taping some for Sirius. Should outfielders change their outfield depth based on whether the pitcher is a ground ball or fly ball pitcher? And the practical application of this, if you didn't follow, is Andrew McCutchen's defensive numbers struggled mightily, at least in defensive runs saved, because he was playing much shallower because the Pirates felt that they had a ground ball staff and a staff that would have weak fly ball contact, and it didn't play out that way, and it ended up having a negative impact on his numbers. So should outfielders play the depth based on the construction of the staff?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is going to be unique, and we actually are tracking that for every team, every player, every pitcher, every combination of park, team, hitter, pitcher. We know where the outfielders are playing, so we can see, like Jason Hayward, how he shifted over by 15 feet for certain batters and moves over for other batters. And they're trying to figure out what the optimal alignment is. And we'll be able probably to, you know, to assist to some extent for that.
This is something we're working on that I think Darren tweeted out a very preliminary version of it, is just positioning. Like who had to go the least amount of distance to where the ball was gonna land? And it's some pretty interesting results. It looks like, you know, extremely preliminarily, the Cubs did a really fantastic job of positioning their guys close to where the batted ball would land. Now, obviously, those Cubs defenders are fantastically talented, but it also seems like they're put in a position to succeed. And that's really just, you know, the best thing a coaching staff or front office can do is make their guys as successful as possible, and by putting them in that position.
Well, Dexter Fowler, I think he played 20 feet deeper last season, so I mean, they adjusted Dexter Fowler to where he was playing, and it seemed to have worked because he was second closest to balls that he was closest to. So, it's an interesting topic.
And to go along with what Mike was saying, Jason Hayward, Mike was asking, how come he doesn't have so many great plays? And Mike noticed, you know what, how come he doesn't have many opportunities? And basically, it's because he's so well positioned that he wasn't given enough opportunities to make great plays.
That's pretty remarkable. You refer to the percentage of chance of catching a ball and then give novel interpretation to a catch that may or may not be visually good. How do you know that the percentage of catch statistic is correct or the truth? Well, it is actually in quotes, but.
Yeah, So right now, the variables that we're considering is simply how much the fielder had to run and how much time he had to do it. So based strictly on those two variables, then we know exactly how often the play is going to be made, because it simply becomes a question of jump, route, speed. But as we add more variables, so the next one we'd be adding is direction, then we'll be able to tell more. Now, for fielding, it's a lot easier because it's simply speed. It's not like with batted balls where you're trying to hit in between fielders. So you're simply trying to go out all out to catch the ball. So it's going to be a very simple process to be able to get that.
Yeah, and we're learning too, right? And we have to, this is so new, we have to figure out what's a significant difference in catch percentage. 1%? Probably not, but you know, is it 5%? Is it 10%? Like that's, as the season goes on, I'm excited to actually see how this plays out.
Well, and another thing is like, you know, like Mike said, we're learning too. So the one I always say is like route efficiency. You can't just take an average route efficiency and say this guy ran exceptional routes, because sometimes running a perfect route, you don't want to. Like think of a sack fly. The outfielder wants to kind of loop around those balls and get in a position to make a great throw. So, you know, a lot of these things we're learning, we can't include in these metrics because there's, you know, always situations that will make it not ideal. And route efficiency is a good one.
Is that one of the keys to keeping a lot of this kind of open sourced, is that you get either these ideas or these, you know, kind of concepts you can look at? Because, I mean, we were talking about this today with outfield defense, either on the jam shot that looks like a big swing and a guy breaks back, or the impact the wind would have, or if a guy is able to, you know, he may have a lower launch angle, but he backspins the ball, it's going to carry, and that might affect the route of an outfielder. I mean, is it just the discussion there, or is it stuff that you're hoping comes about research-wise that helps to give you more clarity?
Well, I think it's we're taking an incremental approach. We don't want to, I mean, we're not going to build a Ferrari first. We're going to start with something small, and then we'll incrementally build up. You know, adding wind, if we're going to take into effect wind, there's a lot of other things we can take into account, right? So, I mean, I think maybe we'll get there one day, but yeah, I think we're going to take a very incremental approach and build on as we go.
So would you say you're in the Pinewood Derby stage?
I'll defer to Tom's answer. We're in the third inning.
Well, that's a good one.
According to an article published at 538.com last summer, StatCast didn't measure approximately 10% of balls in play. How long before this is no longer true?
So the one thing to remember is that when even those 89% that we do track, it's not like we track 100% of the path. So there's always going to be some sort of gap. So for those 11% that are missing, what we're going to be doing is we're going to have the exit velocity and launch angle for 100% of the balls. And for those 11% that are tougher to track, we're going to try to infer it based on other things. So as an example, if we don't know where the ball went, but we know that two fielders converged to a spot, then we know the ball would likely be there. And then, so we can try to reverse engineer what the batter ball characteristics were based on everything else that we can observe. So we're going to do our best to try to figure out everything that we aren't able to track exactly.
Yeah, what works in our favor is that we know most of what those balls are, straight up or straight down, and those are almost always outs. And so that helps us a lot to infer, you know, and estimate, as you said, to fill in the gaps there.
What do you think is the most independent player statistic?
That is a great question. I mean, pitch velocity, I guess. I mean, it depends what kind of player we're talking about. You know, I mean, Billy Hamilton has his foot speed. I mean, I think of Giancarlo Stanton, Billy Hamilton, and Aroldis Chapman, and let's say Seth Lugo, because why not? As like, you know, the kings of the StatCast, but I love Seth Lugo. He's pitching today, and it's not in the StatCast stadium, so I'm very disappointed. But yeah, what do you think, Tom?
Yeah, anything that has the fewer moving parts, so throwing, running, hitting, those things.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Right? So the five-tool player, right? We're working towards quantifying that, because it's always been, you know, what do the scouts think? And we're like, well, we can measure all five of those things. So we are going to be able to do that, I think, after we nail down infield defense, and then see who has above whatever percentile makes sense, and find like real five-tool players, not just like what the scouts think. So I'm excited to see Byron Buxton hopefully show up on that.
Have you thought about? I mean, with that in mind, have you thought about how some of these the data may show projection? Because clearly you're looking for, you know, young players are not a finished product, much like WAR isn't a predictive stat, or many of these statistics aren't predictive in nature so much as their narrative, that they told the story of what happened. Have you thought at all about what you might focus on to see what shows projection in a player?
I think it's a little early for that, but definitely that would be one of the goals, because ultimately what we're trying to do is figure out what makes this particular player, you know, unique, and trying to focus on those tools that the scouts are looking at. That's just really what we're doing here, is just try to get rid of all the noise and see what it is that went into what made this player so good?
Will we ever see StatCast in college baseball?
I know a lot of college programs use TrackMan. I know that for a fact. StatCast is a bigger beast. My hunch would be no, but I know a lot of college programs are getting a lot more analytically inclined. I get emails from college programs all the time asking me questions like, how would you start tracking this? What are some tips you have for me? So it is interesting that, I mean, the whole StatCast thing, exit velocity and launch angles, it's pretty interesting because you hear kids in high school talking about exit velocity. You hear them talking about route efficiency. So you know it's that people are interested in it, and it's starting to trickle down a little bit.
I do think it's interesting that you mentioned the TrackMan stuff. I think there are some teams, that are able to access that too when it comes to the amateur side. There are certain events, showcase events, that have TrackMan available at it. So it's already made probably a more significant impact on the amateur side than people realize, right? And that's some of the similar technology than what you use.
Yeah, I hear about it from Darren Sutton all the time because he works with Perfect Game and TrackMan there. He's very invested in it. But I think Tom's kind of right. A lot of it just gets down to skills. Like, if you look at a high school player who hits 700, you think, well, is he great, or was he just playing against terrible competition? You maybe don't know, but if you get to the skills and say, oh, wow, he actually had an exit velocity that's like 90th percentile in the country or something, that's probably more valuable than seeing, what the output was, because the competition could be all over the place.
Which is more critical to batted balls, the angle of elevation or the angle of incident?
That's a Tom question.
That's probably an Alan Nathan question.
Is Alan here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I will not pretend I have an answer for that because I don't.
I'll defer to Tom.
Yeah, that's
Alan. Have you run the numbers on probability of being barreled by pitcher? Does Voros McCracken's observation hold across contact types?
We have, yeah. We do have that.
And I mean, that's exactly what that WOBA that you saw with Kyle Hendricks, that's based on the batter ball profile. And so definitely there is a skill. Now, I'm sure Voros wouldn't suggest that everyone is equal. And that's really what we try to do, is just try to figure out what is that scale, what is that range. It's a lot tighter than most people would have originally
thought. There's actually a leaderboard on my site that you can pull up pitchers and sort it by percentage of barrels they've given up.
As I remember, the highest percentage was like Chris Young and Casey Fien or something like that. And
they
got lit up, so that makes sense. But barrels is just one of the six batted ball types that we were showing before, and they all have their importance.
This one's for Darren. In a case competition, it created a two-pitch comparison using visual graphics. However, they had a hard time finding two consecutive pitch video clips from Baseball Savant. Is there a possible way to access every single video file available? Do you have the bandwidth to be able to
do
that?
I have been fighting for this for a very long time. We are going to add more video this year. And so my answer to that is we are not going to have every video this year. I'm fighting for it. I think it would be awesome. But we are definitely going to be adding more video. I was talking with Mike earlier. So a lot of these like five-star plays wouldn't be tagged through our media system right now, or four-star plays, because if it doesn't look exactly exceptional, then why would they cut a video for it? So we're working on a process that'll take, we'll say, our highlight plays and ingest them based off our criteria. So yes, there will be more video, but not every video.
Tom, what do you think is the biggest thing that you've learned in now your almost a year at BAM? Maybe whether it either reinforced something that you believed or something that changed one of your beliefs.
I don't know about the biggest, but I'm always like learning little things. And one of the things is actually shifts. I think if you click.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of like an encore.
Yeah. that's what I was going to say.
So we have all 180,000 plate appearances, and we split it up based on whether the batter is a lefty or righty. And we can see the WOBA is similar for the two, the in-play rate is similar for the two, but how the fielders are aligned are much different. For lefty hitters, you get the shift rate 25%. So for us, a shift is three infielders or more to one side or the other of the bag. And 64% of the time, they're in the standard spot. Righties, though, are also getting shifted. So that's 7% of righties are getting shifted. If we split them up and look at their performance in terms of whether they're in the standard fielding alignment, shift, or everything else, which is I call out of position. We see that for lefties, the shift players hit 13 points higher. Now, that doesn't mean that the shift contributes to that extra 13 points. It could be that only the really good hitters are being shifted. So we can't make any judgment on that one. But when we look at righties, we see that they jump up by 28 points. Now, again, we could say that potentially the only right-handed hitters being shifted are the very, very strong ones. If we look at the chart on the right, that just shows the breakdown in shifts by runners on base, and we can see that most of the time it's when the bases are empty. So if we look at the next slide, here we look at the when there's no runners on, so what the performance changes are. And with the righties, that's the big one. There's a 43-point difference between righty hitters hitting against standard alignment against the shift. Now, again, you could potentially say it's only the really, really good hitters, and that's why you have a 43-point. But it could be bad pitchers. It could be bad defense. It could be a bad alignment that they're basically over-shifting. So that's one that I'm be interested to see. And if we look at team by team, on the left, it's the team offense, right-handed hitters against the shift. And on the right, it's a team defense shift against right-handed hitters. The Blue Jays, interestingly, they're number one in terms of right-handed hitters being shifted. And that's because Encarnacion and Bautista are big-time pull hitters. But they're also last team defense in shifting against right-handed hitters. So you can see there's not much consensus as to how to shift. You could also see the Pirates at the top right. When they shift against right-handed hitters, they got a great performance. Their WOBA is under 300. But when the Mariners shift and they're right behind the Pirates, their WOBA allowed is over 400. So again, it's not clear why. It could be that the Pirates are only shifting against bad hitters and the Mariners against really good hitters. But this is one thing that's exciting to see, that maybe the teams are potentially overthinking things.
We are deep into the wormhole now.
Jaron, what about you? What do you think that you've learned in your now nearly 2 years there?
There's so much that we're always going to be learning. Like Mike just mentioned, the wormhole. We find ourselves talking about things, and you know, why don't we do this? Well, because this will happen and this will happen. So I mean, the data is awesome, but like, you can almost get lost in it if you're not careful. So I've learned that we're always going to be learning when looking at this data.
Do you ever feel like that, like you've finally shoveled the snow almost out of the driveway just before another snowfall is coming, or are you always buried?
Exactly. So you can get lost in the data very easily. So yeah, you need to go into it looking and say, what question am I trying to answer? And if you don't have that mindset, then you will get lost very easily in it.
Mike, how about you? Because my feeling has always been that you had a unique feel for what was going on a baseball field and the analytics and kind of the scan, the whole kind of package there. I mean, were there any true beliefs that you held that were dispelled, or things that you've heard baseball people talk about that have been confirmed in these couple of years?
Well, we have dispelled some myths, the myth of hard in and hard out. I think we dispelled that pretty early on. But it's really interesting to, have the opportunity not just to, work with these guys, but to talk to people in the game and say, is what we're doing passing the smell test for you? Because we never want that to happen and say, guys, this is crazy. And we're learning that the players and some of the people in the game are really getting some impact out of this. And that's been incredibly rewarding for us. I mean, I say I have even like the worst day at my job is still like the best day at anybody else's job, because I get to talk to these guys and Jason and Corey and watch Billy Hamilton plays all day and talk to Major League Baseball players. So I think Darren's right, though. Every time we answer a question, 10 more questions come up, and that's incredibly exciting.
But that was supposed to be the purpose, right, of the sabermetric movement, right? Was that every time you ask a question, you should get 10 more that you need to answer. And then you continue to bury Darren.
The hard part is not answering the questions, it's identifying the right question.